For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So, Bible study is pretty much of a blast. It's about the most fun thing I do in my life. You laugh. It's true. I'm not making that up. Really like it a lot. And for the last year and a half or so, I've been studying the life of David, largely with my wife, but some on my own too. And just kind of walking through that narrative of 1 and 2 Samuel, reflecting on the Psalms that David writes about his experiences in life that really bring those passages sometimes into real vivid focus. There are basically 14 narrative sections in the life of David, all of which disclose the kind of the central driving idea that we have in the David story, which is, here's a man whose heart was wholly God's. That when God said, I'm seeking a man after my own heart, he finds this man David, who is a heart is wholly his. And each of the narratives in the story of David's life really, I think, in a poignant way, unfold a different aspect of what that heart is that is wholly God's. And in that sense, David provides for us a real window into what does it mean to be a spiritually maturing man or woman of God. Paul puts it like this in Romans 15, verse 4. He says, whatever was written in earlier times, that means the Old Testament, he said, was written for our instruction so that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope. And so there is just this very intentional looking back by the Apostle Paul in the New Testament to the lives of great people of faith in the Old Testament that continue to be beacons of light to us even today. And so I just want to challenge you and urge you as we do this study through 1 Samuel and into 2 Samuel that you would have in your mind and on your heart that God is using His Word to illuminate some things within you, things that He seeks to develop and cultivate in a deeper way so that you can more fully be the person that God created you to be so that you can know Him in a satisfying and transformative way and so that you'd be more increasingly useful to Him in His work in the world. That's really what this series is about. And this evening, we want to really dwell on a super important passage in 1 Samuel chapter 20 on the heart of true friendship, the relationship between David and Jonathan. And as is the case with all of these narrative sections, there is a climactic moment or a realization or a summary statement that our narrative gives to us that really discloses what the whole section of the Scriptures that we're reading is about. And I think that 1 Samuel 20, verse 17 really summarizes it well for us when it says, he loved him as he loved his own life. This is Jonathan talking about David. And David could have said exactly the same thing to Jonathan. We want to explore tonight the nature of intimate relationships between spiritual people. Let's get a little bit of the background. The setting really begins in chapter 18, where David, you know, has already slew Goliath. He's become sort of a national hero for that reason. And Saul becomes envious of the attention that David gets, and that envy really is beginning to turn into anger. It says in 1 Samuel 18, verses 7 to 9, the women sang, and maybe that's what maybe really got him, I don't know. They sang a song that said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. It says, then Saul became very angry, for this saying displeased him. And Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. Wow. Then we have the emergence of the relationship between Saul's son Jonathan and David, and here also in chapter 18, an important piece. The soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as he loved himself. powerful. We really need to explore what that means here tonight. But then it goes on and it says, Jonathan stripped himself of his royal robe and gave it to David with his armor, his sword, his bow, and his belt. Now, what Jonathan is doing here is symbolic and is super important. What he's doing is he's recognizing that David really is the Lord's anointed. That is to say, God's choice of who he wants to be a king over Israel. And even though Jonathan, as the son of Saul, would be the heir to Saul's throne, Jonathan himself is prepared to recognize that God has chosen a different path. And that he sees in David all of the marks of a person who is really being used by God and who has been selected by God for this purpose. And so it says that Jonathan stripped himself of his royal robe, that tangible indication of his standing and his stature, and he gives it along with all of his weaponry to David. In essence, he's saying, "You, David, are my king." And so with that in view, let's get into our narrative. David becomes aware of the feelings that Saul is beginning to develop against him. And we pick up the narrative in chapter 20, verse 1, where it says that David fled from Saul to Naoth in Ramah. And he said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life?" And Jonathan replied, "Far from it. You shall not die. My father does nothing great or small without telling me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not true." Then David took an oath before Jonathan and he said, "Your father knows perfectly well about our friendship. So he has said to himself, I won't tell Jonathan. Why should I hurt him? But I swear to you that I am only a step away from death. I swear it by the Lord and by your own soul." And so Jonathan responds, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." And David said, "Tomorrow we celebrate the new moon festival. I've always eaten with the king on this occasion, but tomorrow I'll hide in the field and stay there until the evening of the third day. If your father asks, 'Where am I?' tell him I asked permission to go to Bethlehem for the annual family sacrifice. If he says, 'Fine,' then you'll know all is well. But if he is angry and loses his temper, you will know he is determined to kill me. Show me this loyalty as my sworn friend, for we made a solemn pact before the Lord. Or kill me yourself if I have sinned against your father, but please do not betray me to him." "Never," Jonathan exclaims. "You know that if I had the slightest notion my father was planning to kill you, I would tell you at once." So that's the background. David is increasingly suspicious of the Saul that is suspicious of him. He knows of his temper. He really believes that Saul is out to kill him. It goes on, Jonathan made a solemn pact with David. He said, "May the Lord destroy all your enemies." And Jonathan made David reaffirm his vow of friendship again, for Jonathan loved David as he loved himself. So the story unpacks then that David, with all of these suspicions, have his suspicions confirmed. We read on, Saul asked Jonathan, "Why hasn't the son of Jesse been here for the meal, either today or yesterday?" Here they're sitting around their table and they're gnawing on their turkey legs and they're having their big party. And it's like, "So, where's David?" And Jonathan replies, "David earnestly asked me if he could go to Bethlehem. He said, 'Please let me go, for I have a family, we're having a family sacrifice. My brother demanded that I be there. Please let me be with my brothers.' And that's why he's not here at the king's table." But Saul boiled with rage at Jonathan. "You stupid son of a whore," he swore to him. "Do you think that I don't know that you want him to be king in your place, shaming both yourself and your mother? As long as the son of Jesse is alive, you will never be king. Now go and get him so I can kill him." But Jonathan asked, Why should you kill him? What has he done? Then Saul hurled his spear at Jonathan, intending to kill him. So at last, Jonathan realized that his father really was a murderous, maniacal, crazy guy. And Jonathan left the table in fierce anger, for he was crushed by his father's shameful behavior towards David. Fascinating. The next scene in the story then is the reuniting of David with Jonathan out in the field. It says in verse 35 that the next morning, as agreed, Jonathan went out into the field where David was hiding, and he took a young boy with him to gather his arrows. That was one of the signs that Jonathan was coming out. As soon as the boy was gone, David came out of hiding. He bowed 3 times to Jonathan with his face to the ground. And they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept more. And Jonathan said to David, "Go in safety, for we have sworn loyalty to each other. The Lord is witness of a bond between us and our children forever." Then David left, and Jonathan returned to town. So there it is. Jonathan has to go. He basically confesses, "Yep, my father is out to get you. No doubt about it. You were right." And really, the rest of the entire narrative of 1 Samuel is David fleeing from a murderous Saul who wants to kill him. So this really kind of sets the stage for that. What I want to focus in on here, though, is the intimate friendship that exists between David and Jonathan, and its relationship really to the incredible things that God is able to do through them. A few little teasers here. It says in verse 4, "Whatever you say, I will do for you," Jonathan exclaimed. So there's just that I'm totally available to you. Whatever you have need, I've already calculated. I'm prepared to sacrifice, and I'm going to meet that need. Then there's another dimension in its relationship in verse 17, where he says that he loved him as he loved his own life. And so there's this depth of loyalty, of friendship, of real love that David and Jonathan share for one another, such that they could not say that my life matters any more than yours does. And lastly, it says in a deep and a tender way, they wept together. And then our editor makes this comment, "But David wept more." And just the depth of the bond that exists between these two men is really significant. Let's think about the point that we're trying to drive home here. The point about love relationships. An important theme in the Bible. This is Jesus' way. Look what Jesus says. "Greater love has no one than this, than he lay down his life for his friends." He says he loved him to the end. This is Jesus' way. That it isn't that Jesus came to declare the truth and to die for the sins of humanity. Of course, he did both of those things. But he also left behind men and women that he loved, that he gave his life to, that he cared about, that he showed what does it mean to be intimately bonded to one another for the purpose of God. And so this becomes absolutely essential as the church unfolds. We see that is the way that the church lived out its faith. Jesus calls us to it. He says in John 13:1, "By this all men will know that you're my disciples if you have love for one another." That is a very provocative statement that Jesus is making. How will people know that what you have to say really matches reality? That you're not just laying on them some other religious point of view like there are so many out there already. Well, here's the one of the key indications is that we demonstrate that God is a God of love, that God has sent his son into the world to reconcile alienated people to himself, because alienated humanity comes together in real love for one another, in demonstration of the reality of this thing. It's the life of the church that demonstrates the reality of it, of the message. So there is a deep responsibility that comes to us through Jesus' own words, isn't there? The proof of the pudding is in the eating. How do we know that God loved so much that he sent his only son? Because we, as his believers, his followers, have that capacity to love in a fundamentally different way. He says, Paul does in 2 Timothy 1, verses 3 and 4, about his old friend Timothy. They had gone through so many things together, and he just, towards the end of his life, because 2 Timothy is probably the last letter he wrote, and it's to Timothy, and he says, I constantly remember you in my prayers night and day, longing to see you, even as I recall your tears, so that I might be filled with joy. And so here's Paul, the aged, out of the depths of his heart, reaching out to his decades-long friend, remembering the fondness of the time that they had together, the deep emotion that they had for each other, the tears that were shed at the time where Timothy was to stay in Ephesus and Paul was to move on. And so it just really speaks of this deep bond that Jesus himself said, this is the sign. This is the evidence that the things that I'm saying about my sacrifice for human sins on the cross is actually true. How we love one another. So what I want to do here is I want to break this down a little bit. What does it look like to have this deep love? I think there are four pieces of this narrative, this relationship between Jonathan and David that really opens the door to some deeper understanding. And I'm just going to plead with you here tonight. Some of us are real effective lovers in some ways and not in other ways. And the ways that sometimes we are weak, others are strong. And what I want to call us to here tonight is a balanced view of what does it mean to really love one another in the way that Jesus calls us, in the way that Paul and Timothy demonstrated, and which we see so clearly in the relationship between David and Jonathan. Just be asking God as we kind of roll this out, I wonder if this is something that God has for me to really grow in. And that as I grow in this particular area, that there would be the resulting joy of having a deeper, satisfying love relationship with people that God has brought into my life as my brother or my sister. Let's think about this. First, we note that these are men who are prepared to sacrifice for each other. Jonathan said, whatever you say, I will do. And that's a pretty strong thing, that Jonathan was truly there to meet David's need, regardless of cost. And Jonathan paid a very heavy cost for being in David's confidence and the things that he did to run interference on David's behalf before his father Saul ultimately led to Jonathan's death. He laid it all on the line. He held nothing back. He was prepared totally to sacrifice for the good of David. And so my question is for us here, who actually relies on you? We say in a glib way in our culture, hey man, I got your back. Or the old Budweiser commercial, I love you, man. You know, this kind of schlop. And we would want to say, yeah, there are people in my life who they know they could call me at any time and I would be there for them. Maybe you've said that. Maybe you think that way. Why do you think that way? When did that phone call ever happen? Here's the real question, not in some theoretical sense. Is there some long-term relationship with somebody in your past that you just know somehow you're there for, even though you haven't really connected deeply in forever? What about who actually, in real space and time, relies on you? That's the more important question, and that's the question I'm putting before you here tonight. Jonathan and David were not interested in the theoretical question of whether or not they could be trusted. They were interested in the living reality of being trusted, of actually being there for that other person, to be that one that the other would rely upon in their life. And here I just feel that we need to have a category for assessing the depth and the reality, if I could be direct, of our love relationships. And here is one of those things. Not do you feel affection for somebody, but does that person rely on you? Do they rely on your perspective, your wisdom? Do they rely on the resources that you could bring to bear on a need that happens in their life? Is this a kind of a growing relationship where you are learning to actually place each other's lives in one another's hands in a real, in a deep way, in an ongoing way? Because that's what David and Jonathan are doing. They are literally, they're placing their lives in one another's hands. And so you may say to yourself, well, I don't know. You know, my home church is, we got a lot of people in my group. And I suspect that if I just kind of slipped out the back door and came back just when I felt like it or whatever, nothing would be missed. It would all be the same. Well, if that's the case, then what we need to do is connect the dots back to our own hearts and say, what is it about me that I refuse to love in a way that actually people are able to rely upon what I bring to the table? Who relies on you in a real way? That's our first question. Second, putting the purposes of God first in the relationship. This is pretty crucial. He says in verse 30 that Saul boiled with rage against Jonathan. He insulted him in the most debasing way possible. And then Jonathan recognizes the truth of the matter and what really angers his father. Do you think I don't know that you want him to be king in your place? And because the truth is that that's exactly what Jonathan wanted. Jonathan was prepared to set aside his own ambitions, his own privilege as a prince in the kingdom for a man whom God had chosen. And so there's a real maturity about Jonathan's engagement here that is pretty amazing. God comes first in my life and in my relationship. Jonathan and David accomplished something great for Israel. They brought Israel into that place of ascendancy where by the time David takes his seat in his throne in the new city, the city of David, Jerusalem, Zion, that the narrator tells us that God had given him rest from all of his enemies, that all of the tribes of Israel for the first time were truly united around his rule. And the reason for that in a very primary way is because Jonathan set aside his ambitions to serve the Lord. And so there is with that then something really important for us to consider. In our relationships, I'm asking you this question. Are you a catalyst or a partner for the work of God in your relationships? Not do you have an attaboy relationship, a backslapping, beer guzzling, TV watching friendship. That's not bad, especially when the Buckeyes win. But that's not what we're talking about here. Here we're talking about the kind of relationship that actually accomplished super important things in the program of God on the earth. It was a partnership in the truest sense where they were able to to come together and to be that source of encouragement, that iron that sharpens the iron of another man's faith so that they could more effectively accomplish the things of God together. That is the dynamic that we're talking about here. What about my relationships actually prepares people that I love and care about, people that I'm in relationship with, to more and more effectively serve the Lord God Himself? What does that mean in your relationship? We'll come back to that later. A third point. There is vulnerability in this relationship on a deep level, and I think it's really stirring what Jonathan says. To David in verse 42, he says, "Go in safety, for," he says, "we have sworn loyalty to each other." And the Lord is witness of a bond between us and our children forever. Well, they just have completely before God chosen to trust each other. Not just with their own lives, but with their families, with their children. One of the most stirring narratives in the life of David comes in 2 Samuel chapter 9, after Jonathan has died and David has become king. And he asks this question, "Is there anyone left in the household of Jonathan who I can serve, who I can show the loving kindness of God to?" David never forgot this exchange that he had out in that field that day. It meant everything to him. And so there's something for us to think about here, that there is in the relationship of Jonathan and David mutual trust in deeply personal and critical areas of life, and especially including family. And so where I think this is also something that we need to think a lot about as a community of Christian brothers and sisters. And here's the question I'm asking you. Do you open your heart and your thinking about your marriage and about your children and allowing others to have a role in the marriage with your kids? Now, here's a very intimate area of life that most people in our culture just absolutely have no category for what we're describing here. Most of us come from families that are fairly isolated bubbles from the rest of society and the rest of reality. We just work it out ourselves. But that's not God's way. God intends for His people to be connected with one another in such a way that there are always resources flowing into our family and from our families out back into the community. That is God's way. It's fascinating to me when Paul in the New Testament describes marriage and family. He introduces the marriage relationship in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 21, with a summation of what does it mean to live in the body of Christ. He says, "Therefore be subject to one another in love." Be subject to one another. And then he begins to talk about the marriage relationship and the child-parent relationship. All of this matters because we raise our families in a community and in a context. I think that I have received significant critical input about my job as a husband and as a father. I don't want to pretend to you that that's easy to take. It's not. No one wants to hear concern expressed, even from people who love them, that they could be doing a way better job with their kids or with their husband or wife. You know what I'm talking about here, fellas? This is God's way. I look back over my children are adults now. They've gone and their lives are their own at this point. I remember some years ago now, when our son graduated from college and he's going off to New York for graduate school. And it carried significant risks, this decision that he was making, though that was clearly his decision to make, and he was going to make that decision. So we're like, okay. But several of my friends who were also Tim's friends came over one evening, and we had a man fire and libations of various kinds. And eight guys who have been close friends of mine for decades and who have known my children since their earliest day and have had contributions to make to their life sat in a circle, each one personally addressing my son. Here's what I love and respect about you. Here's why I like you so much, and here's what scares me about what you're doing with your life. And just one after another after another. Remember that, Gerard? And that's what I'm talking about. See, I'm talking about having a relationship where we live together, our families are open to the relationships of people who love us and care about us, because no parent has the wisdom that they need to be able to see through all of the things that are going on in their kid's life. We got to have those outside voices. And why? Because our kids are you know, this unspoiled virgin territory, right, where nothing is wrong. Or not. And as parents, it's just pretty easy to be sucked into the narrative that your kid wants to put out there for you. Am I right? I can't see it, but my friends can. And I need them to have that level of candor where they can speak into a situation and they can, because they're trusted, because there's love that dominates that relationship, that they can do something in that situation. And so I feel that there's a concern in this area in our fellowship, as it would be the case in any church, where we are reluctant sometimes to receive that kind of input from the outside of our families, because it's embarrassing to us, because we don't want to really look at hard things. We'd rather believe that things are different than they are, as though somehow the problems of society and youth culture around us is not a problem in my house. How foolish that is, and how naive, how selfish, and how unloving. And we need to have the thought, the intention, and the attention of people in our lives who care enough about our families to truly engage. And I think that this is one of the great misfortunes of the church in America today, and we struggle with it, many of us here in this room here tonight. And I want to appeal to you on the basis of the example that we see in David and Jonathan, that our relationships are not just relationships that I have with another man or that my wife and I have with another couple, but these are family relationships. We're committed to families. And there you go. Lastly, there is affection. And so it says that they kissed and they wept together, and David more so than Jonathan. So here we have the uncomfortable part, as though whatever everything else we've been talking about is comfortable. That kind of display of emotion. Not just warmth, but deep affection that these men had for each other. Here's my question. Are you able to establish solid, fellas, emotional bonds solid emotional bonds where people know you are for them. People know that you love them. Dudes, how are we doing with that? Man, I hate this part of the thing. I really love my personal space. And, you know, physical contact of any kind just is like uncomfortable for me. But there's something human about physical contact. And David and Jonathan, as so many cultures outside of the Stoic American culture, you know, which is really what we are, we're really damaged here. And just that ability to have affection expressed in physical terms. And in verbal terms as well, to be able to say to the people that we're doing life with and who we are seeking to establish these kinds of bonds with, it's not just that I enjoy being around you, I love you. And you mean so much to me, and I want you to know that my life would be so very different if you weren't a part of it. And I'm so grateful to you. I love you. Thank you. When's the last time, fellas, you had a conversation like that? Has it been a week? A month? Oh, don't tell me it's been 6 months since you've had this kind of interaction with a close friend, embracing him like a bear, kissing him on the cheek. Telling him you love him so much and thank God he's in your life. Maybe it's been a year. Or more likely, this has never happened in your life. And what are you missing? What you're missing is that connection of souls that establishes trust and that enables people to relax in the knowledge that, come what may, that's a guy who's going to be in this thing with me. It's not because of what you said, it's because of what you did. And just that ability to connect in that physical way really says it all about how do I feel about this guy. And so I'm preaching to my shame here. I'm not better than any man in this room on this point. But I'm telling you that this is something that is a consistent part of deep, intimate relationships among men, among each other, and women as well, both in the Old Testament and in the New. And it means something that we would have that kind of warmth that is sort of the thing that dominates our relationships with one another, a real affection that we have that enables us to cling to each other in those times of great need, enables us to experience and express joy on that deeply personal level that without that kind of connection, we would just not be able to deeply experience. This is a part of the training for our absolutely ravaged and wrecked emotional lives. So, I put that before you for your consideration. Are you able to establish solid emotional bonds where people know that you're for them? Where people know without any question in their mind that you love them? Let's put it all together. Here's a little matrix here. This had to go back to North America, right? Tired of this emotional stuff. Let's think about this analytically. Good, I'm glad you got it. An XY axis answers everything. I'm going to ask you to map yourself here tonight. There's the Is it the y-axis or the x-axis? Which is the horizontal? I forget. Thank you. All right. From low to high, relational. That's the deeply personal. That's the emotional. That's the deep relating with one another. Then there is the y-axis that is low service versus high service. Here's what I want to convey to you. That there are four tendencies that we find within ourselves. On the bottom left corner where you have kind of a low engagement, low, you're not really collaborating for something greater than yourself with your friends. And you're really not that engaged with them on a personal level either. But you're not some jerk. You are a nice feller. You appropriately smile and participate in the things that other people do. Then you could be a high relational, but really not that engaged in really coming together and having that kind of catalytic relationship with one another where you're accomplishing great things for God. And in that sense, yes, you're friends, but you're buddies in that way. Or maybe you're like so many of us who are really all in on the functional end. We really want to accomplish things together just so long as we don't have to be too close, in which case we're allies. Or maybe we could be like David and Jonathan, true friends. So let's just think about this briefly as we wrap things up. A nice feller is a pleasant person. But they are passive relationally. They are unavailable to really do the heavy lifting. And so it is very possible for you to look at yourself and say, well, no one's angry with me. Everyone gets along with me. I'm a nice guy. Well, so what? Anyone can be a nice guy, right? That doesn't matter. The question is, are you passive? Does it all have to come to you? Or are you prepared to do some of the lifting in that relationship and pursue people and pursue collaborative relating and living so that things actually get accomplished through that relationship? Too many of us settle for a nice feller relationship. We love our family. That's really where we're getting our mojo. But we don't really care in a deep way about anything beyond that. We love those, in the words of Jesus to the Pharisees, who love us. And we convince ourselves that we're really doing okay because no one's angry with us and everyone seems to smile in our presence. That's not love. My friends, let me say it again. That's not love. And we need to take that fearless moral inventory. We need to think about, is that me? Yes, it is you. To what extent is it you? And what does it mean to move forward? Maybe part of that is being somebody's buddy, and where we are really establishing some significant bonds between ourselves and another person, a couple people, a small handful of folks perhaps, and where some of this bonding, this relating on an emotional and physical level, and where we are present for each other is really going on. And I know many of our home churches, that could be said of so many of the people in our group, are so glad that they're in our lives because there is a growing and real relationship that we enjoy there, and that's a sweet thing. But at the same time, those of us who are trying to actually accomplish something bigger than that relationship and bigger than ourselves are going to feel overwhelmed. I have a dear friend, a man who I care greatly for, and for whom we have a very close relationship. And when we're together, it's warm and open, and I value him, he values me. But at a certain point, here's a guy who said, you know, I'm just not going to go any further than where I am right now in my care for my family. I just don't want to venture out past that and to join in with you or with this group to to really serve a broader community and people who don't know Christ and so forth. And so we continue a friendship. But that leaves people who do care for those things really overwhelmed, that they're maybe surrounded by people who want that kind of deep affection but are not committed to the thing, to the purpose, to be ambassadors for Jesus Christ. And some of our home churches are kind of like that. And some of our leaders in their candid moments would say sometimes, you know, I feel sort of overwhelmed. We've got really great people in our group. They really care about each other, but they don't seem to come together and care about what we're about and what we're trying to accomplish. We're buddies, but we're not partners. Then, two, there are the allies. Yeah, we are trying to accomplish the thing together. We're in it. We're in the fight. We're doing our thing. But we're not really all that close interpersonally. And so there lacks this very dynamic that we were talking about earlier in terms of the personal dimensions of a relationship, because basically what we have is a functional relationship. We're trying to get something done together. And so the problem, of course, is that then when the inevitable occurs, and I do mean inevitable because we are all in it in our lives over our heads, and we do definitely need people who are connected to us, committed to us, know us fully, we're going to find that we're vulnerable. So we're all about the work, but we don't have that deep connection with other people to really offer us that kind of protection against our own folly, against our own stupidity. No one's having that conversation with us about our spouse or our kids or whatever they may be recognizing in our lives that is a danger sign to us. And so as a result, those vulnerabilities turn into temptations, which turn into failures very often. Very often, way too often. And tragically, when you read the pages of the Old Testament, you realize so many of these great people that are being described, they didn't finish very well. Because no one had their back on their vulnerabilities. And so while they were all about doing the thing that God called them to, their vulnerabilities led to temptations, which led to failing. And there's no person in this room who isn't heading down that road without somebody else in their life. Nobody. That's the negative. Now let me just say in a real positive way, that true friendship and the friendship that you see between David and Jonathan is really building a life together and a life work together. They did. They loved each other deeply and passionately. And the bond that they enjoyed is so extraordinary when you see David and when Jonathan dies in 2 Samuel chapter 1, and he writes this moving and stirring lament, "Oh, how the mighty have fallen," he says. And just talks about his heart being broken by the loss of a friend. And yet, that wasn't just it. It was also that they together were changing the way eternity looks. They were doing the thing of God. And when we bring those things together and we are high service and high relational, something beautiful happens, which is namely a sustainable and fulfilling intimate love relationship. Now, you're here tonight in part because that's what you seek. And you seek it because you're human. All human beings seek in the deepest sense to be fully known, fully accepted and valued, and not in isolation but in relation to others. That's the way we were made. And here's the good news, which is that the frustration and the loneliness that you feel, the isolation and even alienation you may be feeling, that sense of being separate from and not deeply connected to another person, even if it is your spouse, is a symptom of something that is completely treatable. What it is it's a symptom of the fact that you are alienated from the very foundation of love. John tells us in 1 John 4, God is love. If you want to develop the capacity to experience love, as we've been describing it here, it begins by coming into a true and living relationship with Jesus Christ. That's where it begins, because God is love. On our own, we're not love. We're self-interest machines consuming everything that we think might further our cause. God is love, and he has demonstrated his love toward you in that while we were guilty and in utter rebellion from him, he entered into the world. He took upon himself the burden, the shame of your guilt, and he died the death that you deserve so that he can offer you forgiveness, so that he can offer you new life, so that he can offer you reconciliation with himself. And that's where it begins. It begins in that humble place where we just call out to God, saying, What I seek, I cannot find, but I believe that's what you're offering, and I want that. I want that. And when we experience the powerful indwelling of God's Spirit shaping and molding our hearts, and take those risky steps of faith towards others to build on the relationship that God has established with us, then there's something beautiful, there's something fulfilling, and there's something sustaining in that relationship. And that's what God is calling out to you here tonight. Trust me. Move forward like David and Jonathan did with one another. If you have the Spirit of God, you have that capacity. You can do that, and you can experience the depths of a love relationship that they describe. So, this. How can you become more fully a true friend? That's a simple enough question. Where might you be tonight? Where might you start? How might you build this kind of relationship? I've said enough. Why don't we just draw the line there?
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.